Okay, we're at the end of chapter 20, and we learned about somewhat the idea that you always have to be on guard. In other words, David HaMelech finally defeated the opponents at the time of the rebellion of Avshalom, and he came back, and then at the last moment there was this other rebellion, and of Sheva ben Bikri. And the first rebellion, there was a tragedy in that there were a lot of people were killed. And the second rebellion, only one person was killed, only the instigator. And that was a good thing. The whole city could have been wiped out. It would have been terrible. And the reason that the city was saved, because of a wise woman, a level-headed person. There's so many times in life that if we only had a level-headed person that would come to the rescue, in other words, just a Jewish mother, and her words are just so interesting. Like she says on verse 19, Anochi Shlumei Emuni Yisrael. She said, I am those that are peaceful and faithful to Israel. I'm just a good Jewish mother. I just want peace. Let's not fight. Let's get along now. There's no reason to kill other people. We can work this out. And she does. She works out. And people were afraid of Yoav. Yoav was a tough cookie. He was in charge of the security of the country, and he didn't take any chances. But she stood him down, and she... there's a little bit of a debate about how she convinced the city to give up Sheva ben Bikri. We have a tradition that we don't really give up people to be killed. In other words, that's not something that was easy to be done. There's a discussion about that in Jewish law. Here, the having the rebel there threatened everybody else's security. And it says that at first she said they want 100 people, and then she said, well, I can negotiate it down to 10, and then down to 1. They were willing to do it. But it's just so important. Sometimes we have an important issue to take care of, and there are casualties in resolving that issue, and it's important not to have those casualties. And so this, to her credit and to Yoav's credit, some people like to paint Yoav with that brush that he was just over-anxious to kill. And again, after what just happened, he killed Amasa, he killed Avner, but we have to see that in... if you look at his career of many, many years and securing the throne, he did the job that he was supposed to do. But when he was able to spare lives, he did. If you remember, we had in the middle of the Civil War, before he blew the shofar and called off his troops. They were anxious, they were winning, and they were anxious to pursue, and he said, there's no reason to pursue. Why should we shed blood? And here he does the same thing. When here initially he thought he'd have to wipe out the city, and the grandma comes out, and she says, well, you don't want to do this. And Yoav says, oh, chalila, chalila. That's in verse 20. Oh, of course not. Far be it from me. Right?
I find it very interesting the way she states her case. She says, why should you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the city, mm-hmm. the holy city.
Right.
And secondly, the Jewish people. They were mm-hmm. going to slaughter Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. The way she presents mm-hmm. it is so interesting. The inheritance of...
the inheritance of the Lord. I mean, mm-hmm. This belongs to God. How mm-hmm. can you do this?
Right. And he accepts it from her, and he says, I'm not going to do it. That's basically her quick action is what resolved that issue. Now, at the end of the chapter, it throws in the hierarchy of the government, and that's where we left off on 23. And there's some question why it would do so. We basically know who the people running the government were. So one view is that since there was a rebellion and they had to start over again, so it's almost like the country had a new election, so to speak, even though they reelected someone who had been in office before. So therefore they give you the list of who the different people are, just because this was a new start. So that's one view of why it lists the people here, especially with the defense minister. In other words, Yoav had lost the job before, and Amasa had it, and now over here it mentions in 23, some people say that after Yoav had fallen in disfavor, how did he get the job back? according to that view, that David had heard that Yoav had killed Avshalom, which you have to assume. I mean, many people would like to assume that that secrets like that aren't well kept. In front of an army, you can't keep too many secrets. And so David probably knew that Yoav killed his son. So how did Yoav then get back into David's good graces? So the answer would be that after Yoav did such a good job in putting down this rebellion, maybe he got rewarded where he got his old job back. In other words, and that's why it's in this chapter. In other words, this was another potential rebellion, and Yoav handled it very well. They basically, only the rebel was killed, and there were no casualties, and David was not looking for casualties. He did not want to have that at the beginning of his reign to start over again. And so perhaps that's why it's mentioned here, because Yoav got his job back. It's just interesting. Sometimes that happens, where a person falls out of disfavor, or sometimes a person may not have the confidence of his superiors, and then wins their confidence back by doing something unexpected or something, does a good job. And so that view would be, that's why it says, Yoav el kol sahasava. Yoav became the one in charge. Now it mentions somebody else over here. We're going to see later in the times of King Solomon, he plays a big role. His name is Benayahu ben Yehoyada. At this point, we don't know much about him. He was in charge of the crazy and placey, that would be like the elite king's armor, or in charge of the breastplate of the king. Or one other thing that I mentioned earlier, which you can't underestimate, and that is that there are some very talented people that are just brilliant, but they can't delegate. They don't know how to work with other people, because they themselves are so brilliant, they can't really tolerate people underneath them who aren't as brilliant. And then they end up failing because they're doing too many things. Very, very common when you get somebody who's extremely competent. And so it's important that people that are good people, that they're able to delegate. Even Moshe Rabbeinu with his father-in-law, Yisro, says to him, Moshe, you're going to be busy all day long with this. You've got to delegate, right? That was his message. They always talk about that, how father-in-laws, they like to add their 2 cents or put in their... So you see, David, as great as he was, he had other people. He put people in charge of the army. He put people... it's not a good sign when a person has to do everything himself, where he can't find other people to run the important things. Mm-hmm. So over here, we see the list that he had Yoav in charge of the army, the Nabi Yada, and the Kresu Plesi. Now, there is a famous Torah book called the Ben Yehoyada. What happened is this fellow, Benayahu ben Yehoyada, was I mentioned to you that in the times of Solomon, he becomes the great leader of the great army leader, the great advisor to King Solomon. And we know where he's buried. And there's a great sage in Baghdad about 200 years ago who went to the land of Israel. And at the grave of Benayahu ben Yehoyada, he got hit like by a lightning bolt, like an inspirational lightning bolt. And he felt like the heavens opened up his mind and gave him clarity. And he felt like a kindred spirit somehow to this sage that was buried here. And he undertook that every one of the books that he published, he used the name of this person, Benayahu ben Yehoyada. And we'll see later that he had a few nicknames. He was also called the Ben Ish Chai, the Ben Yehoyada, the Rav Pilim. These are names that are used later to describe the different positions that he held. And in the Sephardic world, he's pretty much the top Sephardi rabbi in the last 500 years. They call him the Ben Ish Chai, which is the name that King Solomon gives him, the son of the living, which we'll talk about when we get to. It's just interesting that... we have this book also, this Ben Yehoyada, but the book has nothing to do with Ben Yehoyada other than that he felt somehow, we do have this idea sometimes that a person is a spark, has like a kindred spirit to a previous person. There's a debate about Eliyahu if he's Pinchas. Pinchas was the zealot, and so it says later on that Eliyahu was a zealot. So some people say, yeah, he's the same Pinchas lived forever, and so it's. But there's the idea that he had that same, every generation, different people have that spark or that, sometimes that position of someone in a different generation. Now, Kabbalistically, it could be the soul came back, it could be it's a chip off the old block, it could be understood in many different ways.
So Gilgul, to some ways, would you say it's mainstream?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the only thing about it is that we're humans, and so we really don't know. In other words, like if somebody says, "Oh, I know this guy was a cat," or "This guy was, you know, was this guy was color," then you know we're very suspicious because we can't speak for God. None of us are prophets. But on the other hand, if somebody has the vague feeling that either they relate to a historic figure, or they sense a kindred spirit, or they who knows? You know, who knows? And so, but this Benayel Ben Yoyada, I'm just mentioning, like I said, he's a very famous Sephardic rabbi. Was the chief rabbi of Baghdad, which is in Iraq. And there are all kinds of stories. Amazing person, left dozens of works. But he felt inspired at the grave of this person. He felt like he'd have been to many graves. But somehow something at this grave, like it just, maybe it was his grandfather, who knows what inspired him or what, Kabbalistically, what hit him with that. It's not something that we would expect, that we would all of a sudden figure that, oh, you know, we're a spark from this previous generation or a throwback. Or it works with in wickedness, too. Sometimes you have a villain who you say, oh, this guy is Al Capone, you know, he existed before. King Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun. And so, in a certain way, you'll have certain personalities that, you know, it's existed, it's been around before. You know, there have been other Hitlers now, you know, or other you know, dictators or other, they like to think that they're the first ones to act this way or invent this way. And we just, if you study history, you just laugh because it's, it's nothing new. It's all the, so it's just an interesting point. If you study the Ben Yoyada or the Ben Yishchai, those are all names for this same individual, and he somehow felt a kindred spirit with him. And so,
Rabbi Feldman casually once he was giving a shul, and he made a remark that really surprised me. It led to the question of reincarnation. He just said, "Well, my understanding is that all souls today are reincarnation, are recycled souls." Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean,
let's talk about reincarnation.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard that idea, but I don't know the deeper. There's an idea that. I think, like I said, there's nothing new, you know, and that. I don't know. Like I said, it's very hard to somebody to speak with surety about, you know, different things. But I think that the idea that sometimes we relate very well to things that have happened other generations, other times, is that we're seeing these patterns or certain patterns.
Okay.
Now, there was a list early on of the administration, and we said perhaps it's just giving the list over here to kind of, you know, there's a new election, so to speak. David got the rein back, and so it lists, there's one additional position that wasn't in the previous one, and that is the tax collector. That's this Adoram Alamas. Some people say that as the government grew, it got more expensive. You know, they needed to raise the taxes, and so they needed to hire. He was the first tax administrator. They don't necessarily see that as a good thing. It's interesting, you know. That's one of the few differences between this list and the one in the beginning of Shmuel, is that we list the tax collector. Adoram was on the mas. So Yishafet ben Achilut, he was the recorder. It's also the one that keeps the records. Shai Sofer was said, yes, so he had the Kohanim. Now, everything is good so far as the list, but there's one other surprise here on 26. The Gam Ira Hayaori Hayakohim Adavid. And Ira Hayaori, a fellow named Ira, he was David's Kohen. So what do you mean he was David's Kohen? I mean the Kohanim belonged to everybody. So there's a tradition that David had his favorite Kohen. And he used to give his presents. We have a mitzvah to tithe, and we have the choice. Though some of the tithes go to the priests, they go to the kohanim, and we have a choice as to which kohen we give it to. In other words, if a person has a son-in-law who's a Kohen, he has a rabbi who's a Kohen, he has a friend who's a Kohen, let's say there's a poor Kohen, he can decide to give the presents, the what's called the matnas kahuna, to whoever he wishes. So David probably had a substantial amount of wealth. He used to give all of his presents, instead of each time a different Kohen, he gave them to Ira HaYiroi. That was his Kohen. That's interesting, I guess, that there was a, you know, he kept a Kohen handy, so to speak. Some people, though, question that right after this verse, there's the next verse, which is full of bad news, and there was a famine. And, of course, people like to criticize government, and they blame David that he should have shared the wealth. He gave it all to one Kohen. Sometimes you share the wealth, you spread it around. Don't just... for David, who I suppose was very wealthy, maybe he should have thought to share it amongst several Kohanim rather than giving it all to Ira. It's just interesting, like you would never, you could read a verse like that and not see anything in it, and somebody had criticism in there out of it or found a point to pick on. But again, we don't know, this idea though that they express that a person should seek to, you know, if a person is able to help the poor, that they should try to help many people rather than only one. That seems to be the idea. If you want to
say that one more time,
a person if they're able to give, they should share with. They should try to help more than one person, not just the same person. So in other words, David is criticized for having his own Kohen instead of helping out several Kohanim. He only had one Kohen. But that's one opinion. Okay, chapter 21. So let's see what happened. Be rav boy, bad news. So some people say that it's not chronological, the events in Shmuel, and so this didn't necessarily happen afterwards. It could be that we got all the action out of the way. The reason why it wouldn't be chronological would be that until now we dealt with what happened with David and Bathsheba. David sinned, and there was decreed that throughout his reign he would have these various rebellions and struggles. So before we would interrupt with something that wasn't related to the punishment of Bathsheba, we finished that. So it could be that this story that happened with the famine happened much earlier. But we just kind of wanted to finish. David sinned with Bathsheba, and he confessed, and God said, you'll have this punishment, and then this was the punishment. And so it all read one theme very nicely. And now we'll mention something that happened earlier. But it didn't want to interrupt with this, because this had nothing to do with the punishment for Bathsheba. This is totally separate. In fact, many people say this happened in the very beginning of his reign. And it's just, we're used to things being chronological. It's not necessarily so. I would say most people assume it's not chronological here. So there was a famine at some time during David's reign, and the famine lasted 3 years. I think it's significant also, when you have a famine 1 year, so it happens, you have a drought, but 3 years in a row is like really serious stuff. I mean, if there's a shortage of food for 3 years, then people are dying. That's basically what it means. Acharei shana v'yavakish David espnei Hashem. And what do? When you're in trouble, you daven to Hashem. You seek out. This word, which is go, fits in very well. We just started getting ready for Rosh Hashanah. It's amazing how time flies, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a special prayer that we say every morning and every evening called the David Hashem Ori. It's in Tehillim, and it was written by David. And one of the things is that David says, you know, he talks about in life where he has lots of battles and lots of troubles, and he says, and Hashem comes to his aid. And so you kind of wonder, David does a lot for God. What does David want God to do for him? So David says, there's only one thing I seek. Acha shu'alti meis Hashem oso avakesh. One thing I ask from God, and he uses this word, avakesh. This is what I ask. And then he asks that I dwell in Hashem's house all the days of my life. But that's the same word it says that it uses over here, vayivakesh. It's the same word in Hebrew as avakasha, please. In other words, when you say please, you're beseeching, you ask somebody. My translation uses the word sought. Anybody have a better word? Sought or seek or... but it's a nice word in a certain way, like it means that in his relationship with Hashem, he asked Hashem to help him figure it out. He sought him out. In other words, he was a mevakesh. Sometimes you'll hear in Hebrew, it's a compliment to a person. If you say that person is a mevakesh, they're a seeker. They seek things out. They want to know. They want answers. And you say to that person, he's a big mavakish. It means he seeks things out. He's looking, you know, he's looking to. But that's the word that describes David. David, as the leader, there was a famine. And it could have said, well, he probably need to plant more wheat, need to do some more conquering. That, David knew that wasn't the issue. God was mad. If it doesn't rain for 3 years straight, there's something wrong here. So David sought the answer. He sought to figure out why Hashem was angry with him. Then it throws in another word, the face of God, which is also interesting. What's God's face? Isn't everywhere his face? I understood it kind of mean he wanted to know the mood, like if he felt like God was angry with him, so he wanted to see, you know, God's face. Like, I need to have a face-to-face talk. I want to see your face. Talk to me. Tell me what's the problem. Right? And that word is also found in the Tehillim, like the word Pnei. It's just interesting, the like I said, the Hebrew, the usage of the, it's not just there's trouble and he prayed, but he sought an answer.
Mm-hmm. Where is that word for faith?
Pnei, in the Hebrew, that Beivakish David is Pnei Hashem.
Well, here it just says David inquired of Hashem. It doesn't say anything.
Oh, mine actually says David sought the face of the Lord.
Oh.
Yours doesn't say that?
No.
That's what mine says. Yeah.
So, anybody else have an idea of what the face of the Lord is? The I think the direct audience. I want to speak to you face to face, God. I got to talk to the boss here. You know, it's.
There's a place in Psalms where David says something similar. He says.
Well, it's interesting. For Shabbos, we say Pnei Shabbos Nikabla. We want to greet Shabbos face to face. We also want to. It's an intimate relationship.
I just can't remember, but something about you. I awaken to see your form. I'll try and find it. I always was startled at that. And I wish I could remember. So if you could comment on it. You know, it doesn't ring a bell.
I'm not sure. It's a relatively common.
Yeah, I don't think he's looking for a confrontation.
No.
That's not it. I mean, he's coming with a plea. Mm-hmm. I need your help. Right. Tell me what.
Right.
You know. This is not a confrontation.
Confrontations, we really don't. They never.
No, it wouldn't be a good idea. That's right.
Yeah, you're
asking
the wrong one in the wrong way.
Right. That's right. But a face-to-face meeting would be like, I really need to. This is my plea. I ask it. I plead for my people.
I'm back one word, if you don't mind. Gavaka sha.
Okay. Right, very good. Okay.
Moshe is supposed to be the only person who. Seen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. God's face, right. So you're touching on a very interesting thing. One of the few people they connect to Moshe was David. They connect, in other words, as far as leaders, we were just talking about the idea of different generations. There's a connection between Moshe and David. They mentioned that connection.
If
a certain similarity or a certain...
If the concept is that Hashem, and I don't want to get off. Well, I know you're trying to avoid getting off on a tangent of Gilgul, but if Gilgul, from what I understand, if Gilgul means that Hashem made a limited amount of souls, and it's his way of refining a nefesh before it goes to Shemayim, then you've got Moshe, who was about as perfect as you can get, but he still made some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So if he came back several different times in human form before he eventually goes to Shemayim, then it makes sense that he would come back as David.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's one way.
So that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he gets a startling answer as to what the problem is. And only Hashem could give this answer. This is what Hashem says. So David says, what's the problem, God? Why can't we have food? Why is this famine? So Hashem says, because of Shaul, the Elbez Adami. And because of the loss of life, Asher Hemis es Gibonim, because he caused the death of the Gibonites. So what's interesting is that we understood that these are two things rather than one. One is that Shaul had died, and it was a very difficult time because he had been taken captive by the Plishtim, and they hung his head up on the wall by in front of the idols, which, by the way, they found that temple in excavations They have that temple with Sheol with the, and I read up now and then about archaeology, and they actually did, they found that idol where they said that Sheol's body was hung up on the wall. They've excavated and they found the temple of that idol. You know, the actual, they don't have the spot on the wall where the, you know, the body would hit, but they actually have that spot of that nation that lived there, and the, that god of, it was like a well-known temple to that god that was there. I forgot the name of the exact, spot. But, what happened was that Sheol was killed, and, the people really didn't know what to do. It was like a very confusing time. The Plishtim were running over the country, and, David eventually took over, but it didn't happen right away. If you remember Sheol's son, they weren't sure if he should be king, he shouldn't be king, and there was a division, and the people separated. So, because of that, there was nobody to mourn Sheol. There was nobody to, there's the idea that people show, they're supposed to show appreciation for a leader or evaluate the good things that they had done. Here, Sheol had just given up his life. Sheol had been everything. He had a nice little farm, if you remember. He was looking for his donkeys, and everything was fine, and he got elected, and so he took on the job that was not an easy job, and he was never properly mourned. So on the one hand, V'yom Hashem El Sheol, number one, Hashem says, you have to remember Sheol. You have to remember what he did for the country, his sacrifices. So the reason for the famine is because of the sin that you didn't properly mourn Sheol. And at the same time, there was a sin that Sheol did that was never fixed. And so it's interesting because at the same time where Hashem is saying you didn't mourn Sheol, we're not saying that everything Sheol did was correct. And it's a theme that's so important in life. I know so many people that you're either with me or you're against me, or you're all good or you're all bad. You're a winner or you're a loser. And people like everything to be black and white. It's not. Everything is gray. I have that with people, hashkachas. People like it. There's some hashkachas that are very good, and there's some hashkachas that are zero. They just cash your check. They don't exist. They have no supervision. Yeah. But if there's something in the middle, they don't like that. Like, you know, is it kosher? Is it not? Well, it's kind of kosher. He supervises, but it's not that. But the reality is that it is gray. There are cases, like when you get invited to someone's house to eat. There are certain people that you know they do it all. And then there are other people, well, you don't think they do very much at all. And then there are others, well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I just don't know, you know. So that, there's a lot of gray. And, life is like that, and people are like that. And at the same time, you can respect the good things that Sheol did. You have to be willing to criticize the bad thing that he did. And it's much harder to be that way. It's much harder to separate. It's much easier to say, I'm not going to, you know, I don't like him, I do like him, than to say, well, he did good, and he did bad. That's kind of what's happening over here. That, number one, Sheol was never properly mourned. And then this view would be that this happened right after David took control of the country. It would be important that as the new monarchy starts, that they credit the original monarchy and the sacrifices that Sheol made. And then there was an injustice to fix. And what was the injustice? Very interesting. There was a tribe of people called the Gibeonites. And they had joined people during the times of Yehoshua. And there was a big debate about them exactly. What happened was that originally the people in the land of Israel were given a choice. We're coming. God promised us this land. You can be good neighbors and we can get along and everything will be great. As long as you follow certain rules, no more human sacrifices, no more, you know, captives, no more idols, and then we're just fine. You can live here. Or if you don't want to follow those rules, you can pack out. But if you plan on living in the land of Israel and not keeping those rules, then we're going to fight you. That was the message that Yehoshua sent. And there was one nation that left, went to Africa, packed out, and that was one of the seven Canaanite nations. The other six stayed and fought. Once they started fighting, they realized that God was on the side of Yehoshua. And in a major way, like Yeshua, there were almost no casualties in the beginning. If you remember from the book of Yeshua, it's like miraculous. He defeated 31 kings, like one after the other. And everybody was saying, well, these people are from the desert people. You know, the Bedouins aren't really that, you know, it's hard to have, people weren't afraid of them. And then Yeshua got this reputation. So the Gibeonites wanted to get their lives spared. But the deal was that you can't offer peace in the middle. In other words, that they were offered before the battle started if they wanted to make peace, and if they didn't, there would be war. But in the middle, it was too late. They hadn't accepted the offer. So they were no longer offering to live side by side but the Gibeonites, they were stuck. They had not accepted the offer. And what they did was they decided to play a trick. They threw a bunch of dust on themselves, and they made them look like had traveled a great distance. And they came to Yeshua, and they said, you know, we see the gods on your side, the one God. We want to join you guys. Let's make a treaty. And so Yeshua made a little, he trusted them, and he made a treaty to be partners and not to hurt each other. And then he found out the next day that they lied to him. They really were neighbors. And the whole discussion about did he do the right thing, did he not do the right thing, but his word was his word. And so he let the Gibeonites stay in the land of Israel, and they lived as converts. And they seemed like they were water carriers. That was like one of the jobs they had. There were other jobs that they had. What they did was they mostly worked around the temple area. They worked with the priests, and the temple was it required a huge support system to maintain the temple. This was before the temple, but even when they had the tabernacle, because they didn't have refrigeration and they didn't have water and pipes and things, and so to constantly be cleaning and processing all the animals and the meat and the you needed a huge amount of people. And the Gibonim, they were working in the temple. They were the union behind the temple. And Shaul, if you remember, when David was running away, he stopped by the temple to get some food. If you remember, he had some of the showbread, and then he also borrowed his sword that they had in the temple as a sign of the... And when he did that, Shaul, in a moment of anger, wiped out the temple. He killed out the city of Nov. And when he wiped out the city of Nov, all of the unions and the support system for the temple had no jobs. And they were kind of persecuted. People were suspicious. Maybe they were part of the rebellion. And many of them starved at that time. And they didn't have a good reputation, the Gibeonites, because to start with, they came from the people that had lied to us. They were really the Canaanites. But they were Jews. They just kind of, we didn't... at that point, potentially, they intermarried with the Jewish people. Well, I don't know. People in those days were very tribal. They kept to their tribes. But anyway, these were the Gibeonites. They were a small group of converts who had come under, originally started out with dishonesty, but who were part of the Jewish people. And during the times of Shaul, they weren't taken care of. They lost their livelihood, and many of them had starved, had died out. And so Hashem was angry with us. When somebody's on board, you got to take care of them. And we can't, you know, we should have got them new jobs. We should have taken care of them. We should have shown more responsibility. And so Shaul, as the king, when he wiped out their source of income, he should have given them another source of income. And so this was a stain on his monarchy. You got to be the king for everyone, from the highest to the lowest. And so even though they were the lowest on the totem pole, these were water carriers, he allowed them to starve and go hungry and not have an income. And so the fact, David, as he's beginning his reign, so he's told two things. Number one, you have to appreciate the sacrifices of those that came before you. And number two, you have to take care of everyone. Even the lowliest water carrier, you got to take care of. They came and they lied and this and that. That's past history. They're here now. They're hungry. They don't have a job. You're the king. You got to help them. And so this was the message that that David was given. And some people say this was like the first few years of his reign. So that's what's being explained over here. Shaul had really... fought against them and fought against them. They were suspect of helping David, the Kanas of Bnei Yisrael Yehuda. So this was the issue here. So David had to do two things. He had to properly mourn Shaul, and then he also had to find an atonement for these the Gibeonites to address their issues. And we're going to see they have a very surprising response. David, mm-hmm.
What? Did you say that they were accepted as Jews now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How, if they're allowed to live on the land and obey certain laws, how are they Jews?
If they kept the 613 mitzvahs, they were Jews.
Did. Mm-hmm.
I believe so. You could learn that they were what they called the... they had other people that only kept the seven mitzvahs.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Either Noahide or they were like Canaanite servants, maybe. But they were at least semi-Jews, at least like half, you know. Servants were all half-Jews in those days. In other words, you couldn't be a servant in the land of Israel and not follow the Torah.
I thought they had the option of living in the land if they follow the Noahide laws, period.
I'd have to look into it, whether they were considered like the Bnei Noach or if they were considered Jews. That I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally... They definitely lived amongst us in believing in one God. Your point is well taken. In other words, there are some, in some cases, that people, as long as they kept the seven, they didn't have to keep everything. And then there are other cases where they actually adopted, they kept the whole Torah. I don't know. I should probably research that a little bit. But let's see. What does happen, though, is at the same time that their issues had to be addressed, we see that they had a very cruel attitude. Let's see, verse 3. V'yomer David al Gibonim. David has a conference with the Gibonites. He calls the chieftains in. He says, Ma'aseh lechem. He says, what can I do for you? Ubama Kapir, how can I atone for our past mistakes? Uborchu es nachos Hashem. Strange, he uses the same word, the inheritance of the Almighty, which we had before. How can I get you to bless us? And so this again, they had been wronged, and secretly they were saying, you know, this is a bad deal here working for the Jews. We don't, you know, how can I get you to bless the Jewish people? So let's see what they want. Verse 4. Now, from their response, you get the idea of what David offered them. David made them an offer. You know, we have a lot of gold. We have a lot of silver. Let's make a, what do you call it when you...
Reparations.
Or we offer you a sum of money to, you know, to make amends. V'yomalogi bon mainly kesev izav. He said, we don't want gold. We don't want silver. That's not going to do the trick. And we actually are not angry with anybody else. We just are angry with the house of Shaul. We realize that it was Shaul's government that did this to us. We're not upset at you, we're upset with them. So David says, again, what are you saying? What do you want me to do? So they said, well, we want to get the king. We want to take revenge. We want the descendants of Shaul to be wiped out. This is what they said. They wanted to take revenge. They wanted to get even with the man that had come against them. Verse 6. Yinatimano gave us seven men, Nidbanim Hukam, and we'll hang them up and give us Shaul, Bachir Hashem. So this was a very... difficult thing to want to do. In other words, they wanted to take... David was related by marriage to... these were his wife's brothers and family. But apparently David asked Hashem, you know, what should I do? And Hashem said, this is what you need to do. And so David said, okay. The Medrash here says an interesting thing. It says that at that time, the people went with them and begged them, look, you know, you guys are poor, you guys don't have a livelihood. We'll give you a place to stay. We'll give you money. Just, you know, let's not be mean to the house. And they refused. They were so bent on revenge. Something in the Middle East that they have in them that they just, you can give them all the money in the world. They just, you know, so they refused. They made a decree that we're not allowed to intermarry with them, because one of the qualities that we like is people to be forgiving and people to take pity. And these people were just, well, we're going to get him, you know, he did this to us, and we're going to get him, and we'll kill his sons, and, you know, it made it clear that these kind of people were just vengeful. And so they made a decree from that time on that even though the Gibonim were living in our midst and they had adopted a lot of Jewish practices, we were not going to let them, intermarry. That was one of the decrees of that time. So, that was the story.
That made things worse.
A little bit, yeah. I don't know what happens to them in the future. But David has a big dilemma here. And that is, David had promised Jehonasan that he would take care of his descendants. And one of the seven was Jehonasan. So it turned out they actually found 8 descendants. So David used his powers of persuasion that Jonathan's son not be killed. The Medrash says that they had a ceremony in front of the ark to determine which 7 were the ones that needed to be killed. And Jehonasan, at first it looked like him and David davened, and then they made the sign that he was to be spared. Because he had promised, Ben David, Ben Jonathan, and Ben Shaul. And so that was the decree. Verse 8, Vayika Kamelaka Shnei B'nai Ritzah Basaya, so he took the sons of Ritzah, the son of Ayah, she was one of the queens, Asher Yoldu Shaul, Vesar Moni, Vesar Yibosha, Chamesh B'nai Michal, Bashaul, Asher Yoldu Ladriel, Ben Barzila HaMichal, he took these children, Vitnam, and he gave them to the Gibonim. He said, here, these are the descendants of Shaul, do with them. Again, the people begged them, they said, please, you know, have pity on them, you know, you don't got to do it. But the Gibonim, they wouldn't hear from. Yikum Bahar Lifnei Hashem, they hung them, people Shibutai Miachad, and they killed all 7 together, and not only did they kill them, they wanted to hang them up as a public stance. First time, Tikkun Ritzvah Basaya, and their mother, she went and she covered, she chased away the birds, and we're running out of time, so it's kind of a sad thing that they did this. They wouldn't take pity on them. The Medrash said that after this happened, tens of thousands of people converted to Judaism, because Shaul was the high class. He was the king. These people were descendants of the monarchs. They were the first princes of the Jewish people, and the Gibonim, they were the lowest of the low. They were servants, water carriers. And they had come to us through deceit, and so nobody ever liked them very much. You know, they had they were the ones who everybody cursed. Nobody liked the Gibonim. And yet, what happened? That in Hashem's book, if the Gibonim were wronged, even if it meant killing the princes, Hashem says, look, fair, you know, if somebody does something, well, I don't care how high up they are, what station they're in, there's no excuse for doing something wrong. And so the family of the first monarchy, the highest family of the nation, of King Saul, was killed. Why? Because of the lowest family, because of the Gibonim. So people realize, in other countries, you got to be a blue blood, you're never accepted in the country club unless your name, you're on the Mayflower, or you're from the starting families, and, you know, very
aristocratic,
right. Over here, Hashem is sending us a message as we start that it doesn't go by family, it goes by behavior. And Hashem cares for everybody. And so sometimes people are reluctant to, you know, to sign up or to join us. Look, you know, someone else is always going to be ahead of me in line. The people who have been here before, the aristocrats, the ones that came on the Mayflower, that I'm never going to make it. And so the message was no, that the sons of Shaul, the family of Shaul, did wrong. I guess you'd have to say they were part of the government, the sons of Shaul. They enforced the decrees of their father. They could have influenced their father, and they didn't. And so, therefore, they were killed. And so that's the episode. We'll have more time to finish it up next week. Sorry, sometimes it works very nice and neat where we finish a whole chapter or we just start one, but we're right in the middle, so we'll take that line.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.